listening to Journeys on Revolution Radio on freedomslips.com and simulcast with wolfspiritradio.com. Join JP, your tour guide today, on this journey of discovery from the known to the unknown in search of enlightenment, knowledge, and truth.
Good evening, it's October the 21st, 2013. This is Journeys with JP on Revolution Radio and Wolf Spirit Radio, and possibly, if I can get hold of it, No Borders Radio. And, No Borders Radio. Okay, No Borders Radio is broadcasting something else right now. So, tonight, on Journeys, until about 5 minutes before the start of the show, I was going to just talk, and I was sitting waiting for the universe. Sometimes I get guests, and sometimes there is a space, and I believe that the spaces are very important, that they're sometimes more important than the planned, because the universe has a way of working its way through the gaps. If it has to, but it would much rather be provided the space for. So, I realized that this was one of those evenings when there was a big space and I was waiting and I was chatting to some of my erstwhile guests, and suddenly, 3 minutes before the show started, I get a message from my guest. Tonight, I'm speaking to Nancy Hopkins. I met Nancy over the airwaves with Luz Aguibena on the show that I produce on Sundays, and I've been wanting to speak to her for ages because, well, she has a very, very interesting background and has written a very, very interesting looking book. So without further blether from yours truly, I'd like to introduce Nancy Hopkins. Hello, Nancy. How are you doing?
Jay, thank you so very much, and it is a very odd kind of getting on the air, but I hope everybody out there in Radio Land's doing fine. I know you're not familiar with the book, so how do you want to pursue?
Well, let's talk about you, because you yourself have quite an interesting history, something that people don't normally, you know. Basically, you've been in with the them, and you've moved from them to us, or at least certainly in the realization that, you know, you're connected with this, because this is a very interesting area of my interest, the whole kind of two civilizations that will eventually discover each other soon. So why don't you tell people about, well, where you come from and how you got to writing the book?
What happened was I was 15 years old when Kennedy was assassinated. And for whatever reason, I never bought into the official conclusion that Oswald was a crazy person who just happened to be in the right place at the right time to kill the President of the United States. Didn't make any sense to me. Plus, I grew up in Massachusetts. Kennedy had been the senator there before he was president. And my mom and dad were both active semi, at least they talked about politics. I don't know what they might have done on the side. So I became very interested in the man at a very early age. And when he got assassinated, it was, I think that a child's mind becomes the mind of an adult when they ask a question that nobody can answer. And on November 22nd of 63, that's when the question was asked of an entire generation. We all turned, why is the president, what happened, you know? And nobody could answer that question. And that's the same generation that went on to be the 60s generation. That's why when we, out of the first things out of our childhood was not believing that anything was permanent. Everything changed in a matter of 3 days. And so, as having that as your fundamental beginning of an adult mind, it's the 60s mind that went on to search for, you know, people that could teach us what the truth was. It was like we just didn't buy into it. So the fundamental efforts of the school systems and the churches and everything else to essentially create good citizens failed in us because we didn't have the makeup to begin with. We just didn't believe it. So I started as a kid. Of course, there was no internet. And I started as a kid to go to the library and look at different... hold on, let me get rid of Facebook. It seems to be giving me some sound problems here. Sorry about that.
Yeah, it's going bloom every so often. That's what people probably were going to ask the question. I can hear this bloom.
I normally get it off, but like I say, we got into this kind of fast. So I go to the library and I would look up different papers and magazines, papers from all over the United States, and I had a pile about an inch and a half thick on the Kennedy assassination by the time I was a sophomore in college. And when the Warren Commission came out and people started analyzing it, they realized that this concept of one bullet killing the president and then going on to wound Governor Connally was absolutely absurd, because what you got is you got a bullet that travels through the president's neck, then hits Connally in his right shoulder, went through the shoulder, proceeded to break his wrist, and then ended up being embedded in his thigh. Now, if you've got a bullet that's done all of this, how is it that the bullet 399 that they considered the bullet that did this, that was found on a stretcher at Parkland Hospital in the vicinity of a Secret Service agent, you know, hours and hours after the assassination, the president's body wasn't even in the hospital anymore. So they find this bullet. This bullet is absolutely pristine. It does not have, it's like a perfect bullet. So how could this possibly be the explanation? And anybody who was paying attention, you know, didn't buy into this. Most people, I think, initially bought into it for the same reason that they bought into the 9/11 official explanation. Because it's such a terrible event that your mind just wants to have some kind of an explanation of what you went through. And if it's an official explanation, then it must be true. And so, therefore, you accept that as being what reality is, and you go on. For some of us, we didn't go on. We said, no, that's not right. So by the time I went to as a sophomore, I went to a guy that was, I didn't think that the Warren Commission report made any sense, and he was going around to the universities. So he goes to the University of Massachusetts where I was a sophomore. And in a very small setting, it was a lounge, there couldn't have been 25 people there. He's telling why he thinks that the Warren Commission was BS. And during it, I asked him about the third bullet hole. And he's like confused. He said, what are you talking about? So I go through my file and I find this paper on two FBI agents who had been at the autopsy, the official autopsy in Bethesda Naval Base. And they both said that there had been a third bullet hole in Kennedy's back that didn't seem to correspond to the neck wound. It was way below it by inches. And when it was probed by Dr. Humes, who was the head of the autopsy procedure, it was like a puncture. Well, the reason that this guy didn't know about this was because it was never, the FBI report was never even discussed in the Warren Commission report. So he copies down all the information, and, you know, I go back to my living, and he goes on to whatever next stop he had. And 10 years later, I find out that 2 weeks after our meeting, he was killed in a barroom brawl in Boston. And at that time, when I had gone and seen him, I went back to, and I lost my file. And it was like I thought I had misplaced the file. I didn't really panic because I was a a university student who was, you know, having trouble staying in school and struggling. So it wasn't paramount in my mind, and it wasn't until I found out about his killing that I thought, well, crap, I probably missed a bullet. Because they probably figured, okay, she's got the information, but she's a sophomore. If we steal her file, she's going to give up the search. But this guy's out there talking to everybody, so he's going to have to be eliminated. In fact, I did not pursue it. But years later, I was in a bookstore, and I see this book. It's called Best Evidence by David Lipton. And I saw this book. It was expensive. I didn't have very much money. It was really expensive. It was 600 pages, hard copy. But I had to have it. I must have known it was about the Kennedy thing, but I certainly didn't understand that this was going to be such a critical piece of reference material for anybody that studied it. His referencing was amazing. But what he did as a young man, he got involved in researching it, and he's quite a bit younger than I am. And he went to a neurosurgeon friend of his, because he's going through the Warren Commission report. Dr. Humes, when he gave his testimony before the Warren Commission, his testimony was so technical that David Lipton couldn't understand what he was saying. So he took it to a neurosurgeon and didn't tell him what it was about. And the neurosurgeon said to him, well, I don't understand why somebody would be saying this. He said, but what this doctor is saying is that he's about to do an autopsy, but that the person who is about to be autopsied has already been autopsied. So, you know.
They'd already messed about with him before he arrived. So they're already guilty of, what they call it, destroying evidence, or, you know. And also, okay, so I just want to... bring in a thing that this is almost exactly like 9/11, where there are two official buildings and one unofficial, one mysterious building, and there are two official bullets and one weird bullet.
Oh, that's true.
It's an interesting psyop, and I, you know, the timing of your book, you know, the date is November 22nd, 11/22, 63, and now it's exactly 50 years. In 1 month's time. So, this is presumably that, I mean, there are these time cycles that, go with this, aren't there?
Oh, absolutely. And, time is, in the book, in Cosmic Reality, I talk about timelines and time shifts. And a lot of, there's a lot of science in the book. Let me back up a bit. So, when I read David Lipton's book, and I realized I got back into the almost this obsessive mindset of finding out what they really did to Kennedy, and I knew that the only way I would ever really understand it, because you can't understand the mindset that would order the assassination of the President of the United States for any reason, and so to understand the mindset, I felt like I had to join the enemy. And so that was why I went into the military, was to spy on my own government. Now, this brings us to a question, an interesting kind of a situation, in that my life has been so controlled and mission-oriented towards discovering the secrets, particularly regarding Kennedy, that my entire focus in life has been finding answers. And that's another thing I try to bring out in the book, Cosmic Reality, is that if you ask the questions, you're going to get the answers. And there is no thing as coincidence, chance. It doesn't happen. The universe works by consciousness, by thought. So every time you ask a question, especially if you ask them in the right way, you will get an answer. And because I was, like I say, pretty near obsessive about this question after question about the Kennedy thing, my life, before I ever joined the military, took a weird turn in that I had been a physical education student right up until my junior year. And in that junior year, after the semester had started, I went to the history department and became a history major. And the only courses that were open to me were things like Soviet history, ancient Russian history, Soviet society. And all of a sudden, by the time I'm a senior, I'm an expert on the Soviet Union. Now, and that gave me a ticket to the top of the intelligence community. Because when I went in 72, I get in there, and they're all looking at Vietnam. Well, Vietnam draws down, and now all of a sudden they go, oh, well, has anybody been paying attention to what the Soviet Union's been doing? And nobody had, but all of a sudden I'm at the Fort Huachuca in Arizona, where the U.S. Army's Military Intelligence School is located. And I get there, and lo and behold, they're trying to put together a program of instruction on Soviet military tactics. And I happened to have, between schools, I had a few weeks' time. So I stayed at Huachuca. I worked with this major, and we put together the first program of instruction on Soviet military, Warsaw military tactics that had ever been in intelligence school. That led to having a name in the area of Soviet. What I could do was, because I understood how the Soviets thought so well, I could go through the military aspects of it very, very quickly and tie it all together. So it was very easy for me to, in 3 weeks, do something that they had been struggling to do for, at that point, months. But I go on to the next school, and that next school is Electronic Warfare School. It's operated by the Army Security Agency, and they are known as the Super Spooks. You have to be in the top 10%. You have to be asked to go into it. I had no idea who they were or what they were doing, but apparently I'd already got the reputation when I was in basic training. Plus my history, my knowing about the Soviets and everything. So now I'm in the Super Spooks, and I go to the only unit I ever ended up going to, and they have the mission of searching for giving the information on the threat to all of the Army's communication systems. That's your telephone, that's your satellite, that's your radio, that's your radar, that's your telemetry systems. We were supposed to be telling the Army what their vulnerabilities were and how they could fix it. Well, nobody knew what the threat was. Again, I ran into the same situation. So again, I was in the right place at the right time and the only person that could do the job. So I ended up becoming not only the Soviet military tactics expert, but now I am electronic warfare expert for the government as regards to Soviet. And so now I'm in a position where I've got the CIA working for me, the FBI, NSA. I mean, there's only two secured telephones on the post that I'm at, and that link you by telephone encryption. So you talk into the telephone, it gets encrypted, and then it goes to another telephone, and then it's unencrypted. And there were only two of those telephones on that post. One of them was in the communication center, and the second one was on my desk, and that was with NSA. On the other end of it was NSA. So, I mean, I've been in NSA. I understand their mindsets. So I've got access to all this information, and the Soviets were just incredibly adept and talented and put a tremendous amount of resources in electronic warfare. But what happened was, as I was assessing their collection capability, the threat capability, who were they looking at, all of a sudden I'm finding out that they don't give a shit, excuse the ant language, about the U.S. military. They're looking at the financial houses, the industry. It was like, why are you looking at industry and finance and not worrying about the military? And so I ended up becoming a conspiracy buff way, way, way deep in the game. And I understood that the technically greatest enemy of the United States was not concerned with our military. They were concerned with what was happening with the industrial military complex, the behind-the-scene thing. So then I get a friend of mine who was actually the head of the Pentagon Security Forces, and her mother sends her I don't know which one, it was one of those Inquirer-type magazines, or whatever they called, And it was an article on a project called Desktop. And it was a Navy project, and they were supposedly putting in a weapon system off the coast of California in the Pacific Ocean. But the U.S. Congress didn't know about this, and they were being financed by industrialists. Well, you know, and she's telling me about this, my security friend, the Pentagon, and she's telling me this. And she says, I get this thing in for my mother. And she said, it's Navy, I'm in the Pentagon, I'm supposed to be responsible. Is this true? So I started asking about, is there anybody know anything about Desktop? She said the next thing she knew, an admiral from the Navy was in her face telling her to cease and desist. So she's telling me this story, and I said, well, thank you so much. And she said, why? I said, because you just put a bullseye on the both of us. Because I'm your best friend, and you just blew one of the biggest secrets. Because she didn't know what I knew about the Soviets. So now you have somebody, me, totally paranoid, plus the fact that I had also found out that I thought I was trying to talk to a four-star general that was the head of the training command, and there was something going on between me and him. Every time I'd send him something, he'd ask me a question that sounded like he hadn't gotten my messages. And I realized that somebody had now targeted me. They were looking at me, and they were keeping me from getting the message out to the people that needed to hear it. So I figured, well, I better get out of here because I'm not long for this life if I stay with this military thing. So that's why I left the military, was because I figured I was on a short leash there. And so, got any questions about that, Jay?
Wow. Okay, so you were deeply in the deepest of depths of the military, well, not the military industrial complex, but the intelligence complex. Can you tell us a little bit about what is the NSA and what is the CIA and what is the FBI, and, you know, very briefly, you know, like, is it, if it's possible to nutshell it, who pays who, you know, what's their function? Because, you know, I'm a Brit, I don't understand, but I just see these letters everywhere.
Okay, you have two different types of intelligence lines. One being the civilian and one being the Department of Defense. In the civilian area, you have the FBI, which is responsible for protecting the country from counterintelligence work against the United States. The other side of it is the CIA, and it's their job to go overseas and to spy on other countries. So they have two separate missions, one to protect us, counterintelligence, FBI, one to do the spying and get the secrets from the other guy, CIA. In the Department of Defense, you have the Army, the Navy, the Air Force. Army, Navy, Air Force. Yeah, Army, Navy, Air Force. That, am I missing somebody? No. The Marines are in the Navy. And they have their own individual intelligence agencies. So you've got the Department of Army that's got an intelligence agency. In the case of the Department of Army, they had two intelligence agencies. I'm not real familiar, but I believe that the Navy and Air Force also have the same type of thing. For some reason, when I was in, I didn't talk to the Air Force and Navy, and they didn't talk to me. I don't know why. I think there was a lot of competition between them. It wasn't just me. They just didn't talk to one another. So anyway, but you have, each one of those has an intelligence organization, and I believe they also had one like we had, the electronic warfare, the super spook type of thing. I used to get reports from that kind of a group. So, but the NSA and all of those agencies are actually funded by the U.S. Congress. They decide how much money they're going to give to these people. But the NSA is a organization that doesn't get seen by the Congress. Now everybody knows it's there, but when I was in, nobody knew what the NSA was. You never saw it in the congressional records. They were getting funded by black funds that the American people didn't even know about. and to explain to you what these guys, what they were like or what they were about. I would get reports all the time from the FBI if they thought that something was happening in counterintelligence, somebody was after anything of an electronic warfare type of thing. So I get a call from them, FBI, and they said, I want to read you a transcript. And I said, okay. And it was a transcript from the Soviet embassy in Washington, and it was a conversation that was recorded, a telephone conversation. So the background to it is, I'll give you the whole story succinctly, but the background is that there was this real estate agent who kept driving by Fort Meade's building that said NSA, and it's this huge building, and he's going like, what is this thing? And he wants to know how many people are working there so that he can try to develop some kind of a real estate strategy. So he tries to go through normal channels like the telephone book, and he couldn't find any listing for this big, huge building that he can stand outside and see. So finally, after virtually months of frustration, he picked up the phone and called the Soviet embassy. And his question to the operator was, can you tell me how many people work in NSA? And the guy that answered it said, hold on a minute, will you? And he wasn't gone. The FBI guy says it wasn't even 5 minutes that went by. He comes back and he gave him the exact number.
I can just imagine him, yeah, putting his hand over the phone. Hey guys, anyone know how many people work in? You know, somebody from the back says, oh, I think it's about three. You know, it's like
they gave him the exact number. I mean, you know, and so like, you know, of course the FBI wanted to know how the Soviets would know this, and I was doubled over laughing. I was laughing so hard, and said, because they're better than we are at the same job.
That's right. They're an intelligence agency. Figure it out.
So, but that's the answer to your question.
Excellent. So, now, okay, so I want to get really dark here, and I'd like to ask you about Project Paperclip and how that relates to the NSA and CIA.
Well, Paperclip was at the end of World War II. Just think about it for a second. You got the Soviet Union coming in to Germany from the east, and you got the American and British troops coming in from the west, and you had a whole slew of scientists sitting in the middle of them. So the scientists don't want to get captured by the Soviets, they would rather get captured by the Americans. So there was a tremendous movement by a lot of the German scientists to actually connect with the American forces. And of course the American forces know that these people are there, and they're trying to get them. Under Paperclip, these scientists were brought over to the United States and essentially became the core of scientific thought that was involved with NASA. Von Braun was one of these scientists. NASA. Was one of these scientists that went on to go to the moon. But you also have really squirrely scientists, like I can't remember the guy's name, but he ended up becoming the head honcho of, I think it's Plum Island, right off of Long Island. And it's a small island that is designed to do biological experimentation. And he was sent there to continue with the programs that he was working on in Germany. And the German program that he was working on was to develop, for instance, hook and mouth disease in animals. They were trying to develop a way to inject a tick, you know, like a tick, with the virus that creates this, and then they were going to take the ticks and put them all over Britain and probably the United States eventually, to kill the livestock so that they would be hurting the food supply. So this guy, this German scientist, came over in the paperclip operation and became the head of that particular facility. As a matter of fact, that particular facility is probably where the outbreak of Lyme disease in the United States occurred. Because again, it's a tick infestation, and it started in the area surrounding Plum Island.
So it's basically an experiment that's either gone wrong or worked perfectly on the population.
Exactly. That's what we don't know. So Paperclip was trying to take all the scientists from Germany that they could get their hands on, scientists who were Nazis, confirmed Nazis. I mean, there's a lot of people in Germany that would, you know, just talk the talk, but really to be in the scientific areas over there, they got into some really, really dark stuff, like you say. I would normally give people the benefit of the doubt, but when it comes to Nazi scientists, I don't give them any doubt. I figure they're evil and go on from there. But they were brought over here, they were given U.S. citizenships, and the American people, you know, just didn't realize what had happened. But see, I believe the Nazis are still alive and well. I don't believe...
Well, that's what I call NASA. Nazis are still active.
Yes. I wish I'd known that before I printed the book.
It's a good one. Eh? But yes, so I mean, so this is one thread. Now you've written a book called Cosmic Reality, which presumably is saying that our reality is of a more cosmic nature than we are led to believe, or that we believe in our comfort zones. Is that right? I mean, have I got the pitch of this?
Yeah, basically cosmic reality. When I wrote the first draft of the first book, because Cosmic Reality, the book that's out now, is actually two books under one cover. The first book was called The John Kennedy Jesus Christ Connection. And that book, geez, I just lost my train of thought. Where were we going?
John Kennedy, Jesus Christ. We're talking about about the cosmic reality and the nature of the reality.
Yeah. I got it back. And at the end of that book, it was so depressing. It was 600 pages initially. I got it down to, you know, within 150 pages or something. But it was so depressing, and I had nothing to give my reader to make them feel better. I mean, if you don't have any answers as to how to counteract what you're seeing, it can be a very frightening experience. But then gradually, because I asked the questions, how do we fight this, you know, I started getting the answers. And the answers came in a slew of really profound insights that very quickly became like the rules of cosmic reality. And the first rule of cosmic reality is what we think it is. Okay? The second rule is majority wins. Because if everybody is thinking of a different reality, you're not getting a really good experience, you know? So the first rule is reality is what we think it is. The second rule is majority rules. And the third rule is anybody in power is going to keep everybody else from realizing rule one and two. So you've got the black nobles. I call them black nobles because that's what they call themselves. And it's this... undefinable group of people that have layers and layers and organization, and to know exactly who the core group is been the thrust of my investigation for 25 years. So these people that are out there that are controlling our reality are only controlling it because they understand that reality is what we think it is, and I mean that, what we think it is. So if you believe that in the 9/11 scenario that planes took down the towers, that's your reality. But we have other people in a reality that say, no, it didn't happen like that. And there's more and more people growing to understand that. There's more and more people who have come to believe that the Oswald Soul Assassin is ridiculous. So every time one of their lies gets busted, then part of their matrix starts to crumble. And as we look at all of the different layers of what they've done, and we take them apart and we become knowledgeable of what they are, they all begin to crumble. It's all built on a house of cards and mirrors and smoke. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that this is all about your three rules, your three laws of causality there. What it comes down to is that if you can control minds, you control the world. And these beings know how to control group thinking through coercion and trauma. More
that
or less.
It's one way that they do it. That's true. But more importantly, they work against us in areas that most people don't go to. They're keeping secrets that would allow us to become super beings. And I don't say that, easily. It's like we have the power to evolve into super beings. And they know that. So they're keeping the secrets from us as to how do we make the connections that will give us the enlightenment to empower ourselves with power that is beyond anything that the average person would understand.
Exactly. And that's what these shows are about.
Exactly. That's why what we're doing now is so important, because the key to it is that humanity has these individuals. The individuals have a conscious mind. They also have a subconscious mind. And that subconscious mind is actually the conscious mind of their own soul. Now, when we talk souls, we're talking not something that is religious or faith-based. This is based on metaphysics. In metaphysics, every time a scientist takes a look at it, they can prove what the metaphysician is saying. And what the metaphysician has been saying for thousands of years is the human being, the physical thing that we see as a human being, is only the energy body that is operating in the 3D environment. There are other energy bodies that comprise what I call the bioelectromagnetic field of an individual. So above the physical body, which is what operates at the 3D space, which is slower than the speed of light. In other words, for us to be able to see the 3D as we see it, everything has to be operating under the speed of light. So quantum physics has taught us, knows now, that there is no matter. It's all energy in relationship to itself. So when we say, well, this seems like it's solid, I've got a computer in front of me, I can touch it, the only reason that that seems real and not an energy is that it's vibrating at the same speed I am. So at the 3D level in the physical space, you're all vibrating below the speed of light, and everything is moving at the same way. The way I explain it is if you were running around a track, like a field and track, and you were running with somebody, you'd have a conversation with them. But if you stop running, and that person keeps running around, and you're stopped there, the only conversation you can have is when they run by you. If they were running fast enough, beyond the speed of light, you wouldn't see them at all. And that's our relationship to everything in this universe. If it's operating under the speed of light, then we can see it in this dimension. But the other bodies that comprise the bioelectromagnetic fields of the human being are actually layers. And above the physical, you have the etheric. And the etheric is almost like And above that, you've got the astral. And above that, you've got the mental. So the etheric is where you have faster than light speeds, but it's also operating more in the 3D. It actually works within the 3D and faster than light speeds. The astral is always faster than light. The mental is always faster than light. So you don't see these things because they're operating faster than you. When somebody dies, they don't go anyplace. They just lose that physical body that we can see. And they're still fine and dandy. They're just not locked into that 3D physical body. So once you understand the continuity of existence, you're a real danger to the Dark Knights, the Black Nobles, because now you're no longer within their control, because you're in the control of your own soul. Now, once you get to that point that you understand, whoa, I'm this multiple energy body, and my subconscious mind is really the conscious mind of my soul, then you have made, when you're first born, they say that an angel touches you above your lip and you forget everything that you knew. And then you go through the experience of living in the 3D. The soul can communicate with you through emotions, because you meet somebody and you go, oh God, I don't like that person, or I really like that person. It's just an emotional response. It's the only way that most people are aware of the soul connection, because your soul is remembers all of your past lifetimes. Every lifetime your soul ever had is there. And that's the next thing that the Black Nobles are very much afraid of, is that we understand reincarnation. Because if you understand reincarnation and you understand the continuity of existence, then you can tap into your own subconscious mind and pull up information from other lifetimes. The reason that I was so successful in the military wasn't because the fact that I had had schooling in college. It was because I could pull up the memory bank of a 4-star general. And everybody that worked around me, first off, we've talked about this before, Jay, I trained as a telepath. Anybody can do it. So I trained the people that worked with me in my office, there was only like 4 of us, in telepathy. But I also wanted them to understand this basic concept of you have to be able to know that there are energies outside of the 3D that will access everything. One of the things I did when I was in the military was, it was an accident. I was really studying a picture the CIA had sent from East Germany of this vehicle that had antennas all over it. And I'm going like, what the heck is this thing? I'd never seen anything quite like it. It was a Soviet military vehicle. And all of a sudden, it was like I was inside this truck and looking over the shoulder of some guy that's got an operations manual in front of him, and he starts flipping through it, and I start flipping with him looking at it, and I go, whoa. So then I check what I know and find out that, that does exist. So I knew that long-range telepathy had given me an insight that I couldn't have had otherwise. And I began to use it more and more to spy on the Soviets. But I would always have to come back to the 3D and the, hey, CIA, I want you to go to this coordinate. I want you to take a picture of this unit so that I could go before the generals and say, look, they got this new vehicle out there, and have a hard, be able to explain it to them in something they would understand. I mean, telling them I'm just in long-range telepathy wasn't going to work. But eventually... Eventually, I did not have to go through that. Eventually, they were saying to me, what do you think? There's so much that we can tap into once we understand that we have access to all of these lifetimes, all of this knowledge, that all we have to do is believe it's real. First rule of cosmic reality, reality is what we think it is. They don't want us to know that not only can we tap into this information, but we can affect the super consciousness of mankind. Because every thought is an energy, and it is attracted to a particular construct of geometry in space. And I know that's very confusing, maybe, but you might be able to see it. It's not in a 3D environment, but it's a construct of space, in that here we're going to put all this thought that humanity has in this particular area. And so when I write the book, it goes into that area, then that area, just like your soul can talk to you, that area of the super consciousness of humanity then begins to talk to everybody else. So that's why you'll see certain, or like the one everybody talks about is the radio. When Marconi was developing the radio, there were two other people in the world that were doing the same thing he was doing. So all of a sudden you have this same thing happening in different places, and it's because they're connected to the super consciousness.
Ah, that's beautiful. You know, this is always something that people have always heard me say, is that I say that thoughts are things that have people. You know, the thought pre-exists the people. You know, if George Lucas hadn't have downloaded Star Wars, somebody else would have.
Absolutely. And I was telling a friend of mine, I said, I better hurry with this book, because I was so completely, you know, again, obsessed with getting this book out as quickly as possible. But I said to her, I said, if I don't hurry, I'm going to be old news, because it was like every time I would write a theme, I go on the internet, I go on Facebook for, you know, just to take a look, and somebody has got a YouTube up on it. Now, what's coming first, me putting it up there or my pulling in from other people? That's the real mystery of what happens is, you know, who starts it? But all I know is that the more people that generate thought and generate creativity, the grander the super consciousness becomes, and sooner or later, nobody's going to be able to have a war, because nobody will even think of war. Nobody will think of hunger, because there is no hunger. I mean, we have to dominate it. And the reason that we don't dominate it now is because the black nobles are focused on one thing, and that's what I call POO, P-O-O, power over others, POO. And they're trying to do that, and so they just keep focusing on that, and they have an organization that keeps everybody else in out of the loop. If we simply get focused on something very simple, like the golden rule, do unto others as you'd have done unto you, and then organize in small groups by the neighborhood, we will soon dominate the super consciousness, and boom, all of a sudden the black nobles are going to have nowhere to go, because there's no more space for their kind of thinking.
You know, as you're talking, the image comes of bubbles.
Yes.
You know, 10 people could produce a bubble, say, 500 feet wide. You know, and they've managed to coerce enough of the human race to create a bubble that more or less has encircled the earth, but is very, very fragile.
Yes.
And what you're saying is, you know, we form our own bubbles, and eventually we'll form a foam, and that overarching bubble of theirs will fall away. Is that the idea?
That is exactly it. That's a very good analogy. Yes. Yes.
So, now, let's so many things I could explore with you, Nancy. I mean, didn't the intelligence people want, you know, really not want you to leave, because you sound like an amazing asset. You sound like the best asset ever. You know, if I was an intelligence agency and I had, I have to say, of course I always talk about people's rays on my show when I speak to guests, and so the audience can know a kind of the energies that are working through, and you have a very unusual energy, Nancy, but one that actually it completely fits with what your story is about, because you come from the Ray One Monad group, which is the group that is sending truth and a true, you know, literally the will of God and the universe is coming through you. And Ray 4 soul, which is quite an unusual soul. Most of the time, of the Ray 4 souls, they have been, it's like when the Ray 4 is in that position, they're usually a kind of warrior.
Did you say
warrior, as in soldier of the light, of, you know, bringing the universe into balance kind of warrior, you know, and your personality ray is ray 3, which absolutely goes with, you know, your communications eclecticism. There we go. Eclecticism. That, you know, you draw things from all sorts of areas, bringing loads of things together. So you're you absolutely exemplified your rays. You know, they've worked through you, and you've worked through them and flowed with them. You know, I have to say the fourth ray and the third ray are both very flexible and adaptable. Is one word. So you can apply your skills learnt in one area to another area very easily because you've abstracted the wisdom from knowledge.
I have access to all those other personalities that have lived other lives. I mean, I've channeled doctors, I've channeled military people, I've channeled it's just I all of a sudden access what my soul has experienced. We have multiple experiences in throughout our lifetimes. I mean, just, I don't know, maybe there's only two souls for all I know. But if you can access that information and you trust it, I mean, the first time this happened to me was when I was working in a nursing home. And I found this guy who was comatose. And I go to the RN that was on duty and the LPN. And they come in and they look at this guy and they start arguing because he's diabetic, whether it was a diabetic coma or an insulin reaction. And I'm totally freaked out. All I know is this guy is looking really dead to me. And they're arguing back and forth. And because my mind was so frozen in the 3D in a non-compute state, it made an automatic connection to the answer. I'm going like to myself, because again, it's the questions, and I'm going like, oh man, which one of these guys is telling the truth? What do we do? And all of a sudden, my higher consciousness, my subconscious, the conscious mind of my soul said, well, this is what it is. And I started channeling this information. And these two learned people are looking at me, and they went, oh my God, she's right. And I didn't have a clue as to what I was saying. I had to go and look up diabetics and see what it was that I was saying. But because I had made this link in this strange way, by the way, he survived, whatever they decided, it was the right thing. But what happened was now I had a link to somebody in my subconscious that was a doctor. And so I would meditate, and I connected with this doctor, and I found a whole lifetime of this guy that, you know, I never would have had if it wasn't for the fact that my 3D mind froze. I often think that multiple personalities are really a response of a child's mind being so brutally damaged that it goes into a non-compute state, and the soul opens up different personalities that can then manifest in this 3D consciousness.
Yeah, I agree very much. I think the Nazis exploited that and created the whole MK thing, but it's an organic process, isn't it?
I'm not sure what you mean by organic.
Well, it's like it's natural. It's not something. I mean, if you have a child who's traumatized but not deliberately and consciously, it forms sub-personalities kind of out of the air, out of, you know, so you're saying that like a past life reality might surface? Is that what you're...
What happens is that you actually open yourself up to other personalities that are existing. It deals with the concept of the human brain, when it's in a normal state, like what we're doing right now, is called a beta frequency. When you're in a meditative state, you go to an alpha frequency, which is the first frequency they happen to see. When you jump up another layer, you're in the theta realm. And then there's a delta. But at the theta realm, you find within the conscious mind, it doesn't exist. You can't pull in a theta mind to somebody that's in the 3D. unless you are asleep. When you go into REM sleep, rapid eye movement, the deepest level of sleep, then you pick up theta signals. And the odd thing is that the same identical signal that you get when somebody's in REM sleep, you also get in somebody that is actively putting out a psychic energy. It's the exact same thing. So what you've got is you've got a situation where at the theta level, you have all these different personalities that are operating, even though they're dead, technically dead in the 3D, they're still operating. And so if you don't have anything happening in the beta level of your conscious mind, then all of a sudden you start getting theta threads coming through. And those theta threads are just personalities that are there. It seems to be random, but you pull them in. And they start acting out through you because the beta block is not there to do this. So it comes down to understanding that somebody that's dead has just lost their 3D body. And somebody that is damaged at the 3D on a conscious level has access to all of these theta personalities that are existing in the theta state. And that's why when you've got people like a super soldier, somebody they're trying to break in order to get to this theta control mechanism, they have to destroy the child's mind, the beta mind. That's why.
And that's the awful thing.
Yes, it is. But the truth of the matter is that none of that has to be done. All you have to accept the theta signal, and boom, he is super.
Nancy Hopkins, please don't go away. People listening, please don't go away. This is fascinating stuff. This is right up my street, Nancy. Thank you so much for coming up. Don't go away. We've got a little break, and we'll be back in a few minutes. Welcome back to Journeys with JP, and my guest tonight is Nancy Hopkins, who has really got some juices flowing here in the chat room. Everybody's enjoying the conversation that we're having, and we got a couple of questions which we'll put out in a little while. So where were we before the break?
Sir, but I wanted to tell you that your discussion of Ray's in regard to me was dead on. I don't know you. We know each other through that one radio program, but I found your analysis to be very impressive. I just wanted to throw that out to you. And I also want to tell people that they can find the book Cosmic Reality on cosmicreality.weebly.com. Weebly spelled W-E-E-B-L-Y. So it's cosmicreality.weebly.com. Okay, so there's my pitch.
And absolutely, I just messed up my clipboard, so I was going to try and post that into the chat room here, but I've messed everything up. Oh, God. Hang on a second. Tile horizontal. That's better. All right, I can see them again now. Yes, the cosmicreality, .weebly.com. I'm gonna just post them in the chat room so people can get to that and examine for themselves. So, right. Okay. So, let's deal with the question. This is from Dolly in the Wolf Spirit chat room. And she says, she asks, what is a ghost? And how does a ghost become a ghost who can sometimes talk with people? Now, there's some interesting questions there.
Actually, if they go to that website, there's in the tab that says more, there's a ghost story that I've got in the book. And, when I was like 16, I was working in a laundry, which meant that we would, they'd wash and iron the clothes and then give it to the people that have uniforms, that type of thing. And one of the people that was there, we go out on Fridays when we get paid, we go out and have a pizza. So we're at the pizza place and she starts telling me this ghost story. And at the time, I didn't believe in ghosts. I mean, it was like, I was 16 years old. I mean, it was a Catholic. You didn't talk about ghosts. And she tells me this story that, like I say, is written up on the Cosmic Reality website. And it changed my entire life because I knew, I went and I talked to her. Then I went and picked up her sister and had her tell me the story. I ended up at their house, and their mother was there who I met. She asked me to stay to dinner, and then she related even more about this story that the girls didn't even know. It all of a sudden opened up a whole new genre of thought, which is, whoa, people live after life and they go on as ghosts. I mean, one of the reasons I believe in reincarnation is because I was the oldest of 10. And we moved away from the grandparents, and so Mom was really busy. She never told us about stuff. We just learned how to live in the sandbox. But they also never said that my memories of past lifetimes weren't true. I just thought everybody remembered past lifetimes. I was 12 years old before I realized that nobody did. So I had gone from a 12-year-old now thinking, well, I was really a creative kid because I remembered all these past lifetimes, to confronting at 16 years old somebody who's talking about ghosts. And I'm trying to think, okay, does this connect to reincarnation? Well, how does this work? And, you know, again, asking the questions. So what a ghost is, it goes back to that concept of the beta mind not being adjusted correctly. In other words, if you got a mother who lost a child and can't get over it, and they get stuck in time, it goes to a concept of every time you think, not only do you put that thought into the super consciousness, but you also file it right where you are. Every thought you have is somewhere in your bubble, Jay, because I do think of terms of bubbles, that we have these bubbles that we live in, that we manifest, that, you know, our external, it's like a bubble bath, and we're going through existence and, you know, bumping into things and picking up things. So over the years, I got a feeling for what a ghost is simply because I understood the connection to energies and time. Because when you think of time, we've been told that it is a designated 60 minutes, 60 seconds. Time is not any of that. Time is simply a relationship of place and space. They took two atomic, you probably know the story, but they took two atomic clocks and had one on Earth and one rotating in a satellite, and the clocks changed because of their geopositioning. Everything is locked into space and place. So time is an illusionary thing. So when you have a haunting, like, you know, somebody goes into a house and all of a sudden they're getting spooked out, well, it's quite conceivable that one of two things happened. Something happened that was so bad it left a residual resonating energy. And in the book, I explain how this happens. It's scientific. They've actually took a DNA and they put it in a vial. Then they took a laser beam and they put the laser so that it was going, you know, illuminating the DNA. And all of a sudden, the laser beam, which is a solid beam of light, goes into the shape of the DNA. And, you know, it's like, whoa, that. And then they took the DNA out of the vial, and the laser kept doing this. It kept following the DNA spin, even though the DNA wasn't there. That's what one kind of haunting can be. If you go to a Civil War battlefield where I have been, you can smell the blood, you can hear the pain, you can here, everything is still there if you open up to it. It just is residual in the place. And it's not like it's attached to the place. It's attached to the place and space within a certain time frame. It's kind of hard to understand, but it's basically residual energy gets stuck in time in a particular place. That's one kind of haunting. Another kind of haunting is when you have somebody who is normally either attached to a particular physical location or a particular person. And they are basically, they just can't let go. And the only difference between talking to somebody in the 3D and talking to somebody who's in, doesn't have the 3D, is that they're still hearing you, but you can't hear them because you have not finessed the ability to be able to open up to their energies and their energies being the frequency of their energies. That's why when you see a medium, like Long Island Medium, she is amazing. Teresa, when she's in that state of just being out there, she is operating in a slightly higher frequency than the 3D. She works at the 3D, but she's also pulling in higher frequencies. So she can talk to dead people. Well, dead people who are not happy with being dead and are still stuck, they're kind of like got disconnected from their soul. And there's a personality that's stuck with either a person or in a location. In either of those cases, there are ways that they can slow down their vibrations enough to make effects within the 3D. So, you know, all of a sudden the water turns on. Oh, turn down the water. You know, they can do these type of things, but there also has to be the correct, let's say, place again and space. The only way they can do that is if there is an environment of excessive energy that they can then tap into in order to manipulate the 3D. So very often in a haunting situation, you don't have people who are bothered by the haunting and don't seem, you know, and then they move out. And then you got somebody that moves in and all of a sudden you've got a haunting happening. Why? Because the people that moved in were more open to these energies, these higher energies, and also fearful. Because fear puts out so much energy that a person who's on the other side and outside of being able to control the 3D, they can control the 3D when there's a tremendous amount of excessive energy, in this case, fear. But also you see that, you know, a dark and stormy night and there's a haunting. Well, that's because when you've got all that electricity and all that weather phenomena going around you, you end up having excess energy. So I hope I answered your question.
That's very interesting.
Jay, I'm not hearing you. I don't know if you're hearing me. Well, I'm not sure what happened, so I'm just going to tell you what I'm seeing on this side in case somebody's out there and doesn't know.
Nancy, go ahead and talk, Jay's because it looks
off.
Like JP has fallen off.
I think he might be dead in the water, but hopefully we'll get back in a minute. Be patient, please.
I'm remembering a Ryder truck, like a truck that was with a young.
Hi, can you hear me now? Oh boy. I'm here. I'm here.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
No. I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Oh, yes. We're back.
Oh, that was crazy.
It sounds like there's a lot of background noise on your microphone, and if you know how to turn it down, that would be good. Because you're coming across all right, but it's like that you've got buses or it sounds like vehicles or rushing sounds.
I can hear it, but that's not me.
All right, how weird. I wonder where that's coming from. Anyway, so meanwhile,
out there.
I'm sorry?
I said we must post out there.
Yeah, must be. Actually, I have had conversations over Skype, and suddenly this kind of weird little echo bleeping kind of comes along the line. Beep, 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 beep. And it's somebody calling, you know, and, you know, somebody's trying to join the conversation.
Oh.
Yeah. Happens that way. But I don't know who's trying to join the conversation today. I thought I had dealt with all my local ghosts. Because what happens is, once I cleared these ghosts and helped them into the light, a whole bunch of others come along now, and there's a whole queue.
A whole queue of ghosts? Are we talking about ghosts or real people?
Ghosts, who were real people, yeah.
Oh, you got, maybe I missed something. You might have been talking and I didn't hear something.
Oh, right. Well, I was saying that, in the last, 9-10 months, I've discovered that I've got, I don't know, an ability now, to speak to ghosts. Because, they appeared in my house and I helped to bring them into the light and they went and the house was cleared. And now I get, more visitors, as it were. People come along, ghosts come along to be released.
Well, that's the problem anytime you open yourself up to these kind of energies. Mediumship is that anybody who, you're like a beacon out there now. Oh, he can hear us, he can hear us. And, you know, that's, I tell people in my book, I say, yes, you can open up to this, you can become mediums, but do you want to? You know, we've got so many things on this side of the 3D to deal with, you know, we don't really need to be dealing on that side. And I tell them, I say, you know, you can try to make connections with people that you know that were on the same path as you. The only difference between you and them is that you're still on a mission and they're not. And you can try to make that mediumship kind of connection to them. But what's happened to you is that you're open to them now, and so they keep talking to you. You run into the same situation if you become very telepathic. You start listening in on people. They're talking to you out of their mouth and you're reading their minds. I just stopped doing it because it's you know, you see so much in people at that level, and I again warn my readers, get telepathic with the people that are close to you, but put up barriers, and you can put up barriers. If you want to help them, Jay, then talk to them. Listen to them and help them to the light. Maybe that's your mission now. But if you're finding that this is taking, draining you from your own mission, then, you know, just kindly ask that, you know, there be a blockage so that these people can't keep communicating with you. And you can take it down at any time. But you do have that kind of capability of saying, yes, I will, or no, I won't. And it just really depends on you understanding why you might want to do this, or why you might should not do this. But that, you know, that's something that you individually would have to know.
Yeah. Well, I was on an interstate flight several years ago, and it was a very empty airplane. And I got into conversation with one of the hostesses, and you know, what do they call them, cabin crew these days. But she told me a story about things that happened, and one of them was that she does this, you know, not for a living, but it's one of the things that she did. And hearing her story, I thought, what a wonderful thing to do, to help people through who were stuck in their lives, and to you know, it generally helps the flow of incarnation for that to happen. I thought that's a really nice thing to do, and I have kind of aspired to it. So I would say it's a manifestation. It's not too much of a bother because I don't go out much. And so I maybe have like, one or two, visitors, I call them, a month, which is, you know, it's enough to get going with.
Yeah, I can see exactly how you manifested that. My brother Phil, who passed over about 8 years ago, he likes to show up for Notre Dame football. He went to Notre Dame, he comes over when I'm watching the game. And yesterday he was here, and I said to him, you know, Phil, with all due respect, you're a dead person. Don't you have something better to do than to watch football? And he filled my mind with so much of an understanding of what a dead person really is. What I suggest to you, Jay, is that you use this as an opportunity to also educate yourself. When they're coming to you, they may also have information that you would find very valuable. So look at it as an opportunity to actually reach out to them and say, do you have a message for me? Or, you know, whatever you feel at the time needs to be said.
That sounds like a very good strategy. It's an exchange. Has to be an exchange, so that sounds fair enough, doesn't it?
Yes, and be prepared because they can dump a whole lot of information into your head. Just let the images come in, because one of the things that I talk about in the book and that I find absolutely totally fascinating is the DNA. In the Western society, well, let's put it to you this way. This is what we have been told publicly is the position of the Western scientists. DNA is used to make protein, but only 10% of the DNA seems to be directly work with building proteins. So they say, well, 90% of DNA, we don't know what it is, so it's got to be junk DNA. Now, the Russians on the other side, they said, well, 10% of it makes protein, so 90% of it's got to be doing something else. Let's find out what it is. And what they discovered was that DNA is an internet, a biological internet that's based on, instead of the binary system, it's based on four different, instead of 0, 1, it's based on 1, 2, 3, 4. So it holds a tremendous amount of information. And that information, is sent through basically laser beams. Think of tiny, teeny, weeny little DNA sized laser beams that are created when the DNA is vibrating. So what you got is you got vibration as being able to affect at the DNA level.
Yeah, this is the full 15 nanometer frequency, isn't it?
Yes, it is. But what the Russians found out was that the most powerful way of changing the DNA frequency was through human language. So every word that anybody hears or speaks actually affects their DNA. And that's where you get down to the concept of opening up to various energies. If you say, I want to have this kind of a situation, I really think this would be fun, then your DNA is going to take that and it's going to do something with it. It's the point of manifestation. So it really comes down to if you want to take control over what is being manifested, you have to understand that you have to take control of everything around you, including the sounds. If somebody is yelling and screaming, get out of there, they're hurting you at the DNA level. You know, we have to understand that it's all interconnected in such a complex and yet simplistic way. So as far as being open to any kind of telepathy or mediumship, and really mediumship is telepathy in another level, but when they're talking to you, they don't have the ability to, I don't know how you get it. I normally will get, so I have conversations, but only with my brother and my mother and father, the people that have passed that I had had conversations with. But a lot of times you'll feel that you're getting visual pictures from somebody. And that's because when we were first looking at telepathy and training at it, we discovered that some people work very well with words, but other people are just using images. So when you're in that environment, if you just become very open and be aware that they may be trying to send you pictures, and pictures worth a thousand words. So sometimes it's visual. You might not be really hearing anything, but you're seeing pictures in your mind.
Yeah, sometimes it's places, and sometimes it's feelings, which are like knowings. That's like a whole package of stuff.
You're getting that. You're actually getting pictures. The feelings are your interpretation of pictures that are coming into your brain that your brain really doesn't know how to deal with. So you have to kind of set your brain up and say, look, we're gonna start accepting in this other energy. And it's going to seem kind of weird to your brain, but it's okay. Again, it goes back to that first rule. Reality is what we think it is. So your brain has to be open to the visual pictures as well as the feelings. Feelings are easy. People get the feelings all the time. Getting to a point where you can actually envision what they're sending takes a little bit more of a, okay, I'm just going to open up here. I'm going to just let this come through. And it takes training. That's all.
Yeah, I mean, that's always been my difficulty, is being able to see things. And even in the physical world, I've got, like, astigmatisms and long sight and stuff like that, and color blindness and all these impairments that prevent me from seeing things as they are. So I have to figure it out, really. Odd thing.
Well, it may just be that that what you're seeing manifested in the 3D with the weakness in your eye system at the 3D is simply because you are so powerful in the faster than light energies. Just kind of like the way I do it sometimes is I think of a movie screen. I'm looking at a movie screen. And I just kind of sit back and relax, and I just let whatever's coming through come across on the movie screen. That's how I initially developed the ability to be able to see images and see, I mean, complex imaging. Because what happens is that in a symbol, there's all sorts of symbols. We know this. The sacred geometry and the sacred languages involved in there are all within a concept of symbolism. And we may not we understand a logo. We see a logo and we have a certain amount of instantaneous, I know the bottle, I know the taste, I know, so that there's things that are triggered by that symbol, that logo. Well, some of these symbols are very complex, and what happens is that you get a geometric imaging or sometimes a pictorial type of thing in your head, but that is sending so much information into your DNA internet that you won't even be able to process it for a while. So that's why the visualization can be so very powerful, is that there's so much that's being given, and you just start resonating with the energy that's being depicted in your head, and that frequency is actually a complex coding system that's sent to your DNA. I don't know if that's a little bit over the hill, but that's basically what it is. So just try to, you know, work on letting, because you could be a tremendous visualizer and you might, you know, be fighting it because of your 3D impairments.
How very interesting. So it's like, although Beethoven was deaf, he was still able to compose music, you know, like, because he was able to hear beyond the audible.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Interesting. I wonder what that background sound is. It's a weird thing.
It sounds like it's over you, but I would think it's over me.
Yeah. There's not something that's happening here. Let's take that off. Yeah. No, still there. Anyway, we'll see if we can work with it. So this is fascinating. So let's go back to your book, because that's a good focus. But I would, you know, Nancy, it would be wonderful to have you on. Have you ever done any, YouTubes or, like, you know, you said you trained your staff to, your colleagues to be telepathic. How was that? How did you do that? And is it possible you could do it over the radio?
Well, anything's possible. What I did was, I basically chose the people that had the right kind of minds. Not everybody is malleable enough in their... You have to feel real comfortable in your own skin to ever get outside to say, I'll take a chance. I'll, you know, maybe these things coming into my head are true. Maybe it's real. You have to feel real comfortable with yourself. So I only hired people to work with me that were comfortable with themselves. And once you got them comfortable with themselves, then you just start to see where they're at. How are they? Are they visualizing, or are they verbal? And the way that you do that is basically by playing parlor games with telepathy. I got so that I other things, but cards are great. You just take a stack of cards and. I would look at it and I'd say, is this black or red? And the person would have to tell me if it was black or red. And what I would do is I would send the picture visually, just see it in my head. And if they picked it up that way, I'd say, okay, they're visually oriented. Or if they didn't, then I'd start saying the word black, 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 black. I'd see it spelled out, black, black, black. And you go through it and you go through it slowly. You go just red and black, either way, either way. And when you see them starting to get enough of a right, they're hitting it more often. You got the 50-50 chance thing. If they start going over 50, you know, either way, if all of a sudden they're getting many too many wrong, then what's happened is that their brain is now tuned in but freaking out, and so it's blocking the information. That's why some people just can't seem to get it, because their minds are freaked out. Well, I can get around that too, but most people would have a difficulty with that. They just can't handle it. So if you've got somebody that is either visually seeing it or they're hearing the words, they pick it up by words, then you start to just play with it. By the time this one, I was working with this major from another office. And he's sitting in my office because I'm reading a report that he wanted me to reread. And so it was probably, I bet it was 10 minutes that he was there, maybe more, maybe 15. And I'm reading it, but I'm also having things happening in the office. And finally, I finish it, and I said, okay, and I start to talk to him about it. And he goes, I got to tell you, this office is kind of scary. And I said, what do you mean it's scary? He says, none of you people ever say a full sentence. And I said, well, it's because we use telepathy. And he rolled on the floor laughing. He was laughing so hard, he couldn't believe it. So a couple of days later, I go down to his office to read some, same report, but from his, another thing. And he's reading this time. And I'm sitting there, and, no, I was reading. I was reading again. The first time he was reading my report, the second time I was reading his report in his office, and I'm sitting there, and I'm realizing that he's having a sexual fantasy about me. So I kind of like let him go through the sexual fantasy and pretend I'm continuing reading, and I put it down and I said, you know, I told you yesterday that we use telepathy. I'm going to tell you exactly what just went through your head. This guy nearly died. I mean, he... so embarrassed. But he said to me, will you teach it to me? And I said, absolutely. And he became one of my best students. So anybody, it can be taught to anybody, whether it should be taught on a wide basis, I don't know. I would have to ponder that. But I highly stress that the basic fundamental thing you have to do is you have to feel real comfortable with your own mind, and you have to be able to shut your mind down to pick up the energies. if you're continually talking, you're not going to pick up these energies. So people that understand meditation, and praying is talking to God, but meditating is listening to God. And in my realm of the universe, God is a multitudinous different types of spirits. You know, it's the frequency, it's the delta frequency, actually. But when you're listening, when you're in a meditative state, you really have to empty your brain. And to be telepathic, you have to be able to empty your brain and accept information that's coming through. So in the office environment, if my secretary said to me, Lieutenant, what about that? Okay, I'm immediately dropping anything that's in my mind and picking up what's in her mind. And I would say, well, yeah, it's all scheduled. So you don't have a complete sentence, but it's telepathically you do. Because we just got to work with each other on a daily basis. And it was you got to imagine it was a high pressure job. I mean, God bless them all. God bless me that we all survived it. You know, so, but you have to be very, very secure in your own being, and you have to be able to empty your brain to just feel real comfortable saying, I'm just going to sit here and see what happens. And, to be telepathic successfully.
Wow. That's a great story. So, you know, obviously, sexual fantasy is not a worded thing. I mean, he's not saying, I want to, you know. So, how does that get experienced?
It was playing out in my head like a video.
Oh, crap.
No, it's a man. It was okay. I mean, I was enjoying it. But, you know, I mean, it was not appropriate. He was married, you know?
Well, you know, I was thinking while you're telling the story that you're going to, you know, finish the report and say, was that good for you?
No, I didn't do that.
That would have been quite cool. So that's fascinating, Nancy. And you know, people are, again, very, very interested in the chat room. And we got a couple of questions. My girlfriend would kill me if I didn't ask you her question. So, actually, I'm not scared of her at all, even though she's bigger than me and stronger and all that stuff. Meanwhile, she's asking about the Spear of Destiny. You've got the Spear of Longinus on your site in that little montage there. I've heard some very interesting things that the metal that it's made of doesn't come from this planet. Do you know anything about that? And well, you know, what about the Spear of Destiny?
Okay, being that I remember reincarnation, okay, and that I was a military person, what happened was I was going for a job interview for teaching in the western part of Massachusetts, and it was this town I'd never even heard about. And I come into this town, and I'm going like, oh, my God, I've been here before. It was like deja vu. I could tell you every building in this town. It was really weird. And years later, I discovered that George Patton's wife lived there. And that made me take another look at Patton, because I had had so much of a memories of a past lifetime in World War II, like, you know, I mean, past lifetime memories. So because of this deja vu thing with the wife of Patton, I started looking at Patton. And once I got into accessing Patton's memory bank, and it's not like you remember everything. It's like you kind of like, okay, my crew, when I was in the military, they would laugh because I'd get some jerk-off general that's in my face, and all of a sudden I'd channel Patton, and this guy would just back off so fast, you know, and they loved to see it, you know, and I told them, I said, I'm channeling George Patton, get out of my way, you know. So they'd actually come up to me and they'd say, hey, can we see Patton today? You know, but it wouldn't come through unless I was feeling attacked. And then immediately Patton would come in to protect me and like, ba 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 ba. And so you have these weird kind of relationships. So I had a very good friend of mine that worked in a library, and she comes over one day, and this is when I was in the military, and she says, somebody donated these. We don't have any room for them, and they're all on metaphysical subjects. I thought you'd like them. I said, oh, yeah, sure, put them over there. So she puts them on the bookcase. And a couple days later, I picked them up to move them, and one of the books from the middle of the stack, and there had to have been 8 books there, just not just fell out, it flew 3 feet into the middle of the living room. And I went, whoa, I guess I'll take a look at that. And so I put the books back down, I go over and I pick it up, and it was a book, The Spear of Destiny by Ravenscroft, Trevor Ravenscroft. And the reason that happened was because George Patton knew of The Spear of Destiny. And the reason that he knew about it was he was a metaphysician, and he was connected, let's put it that way. But The Spear of Destiny, written by Ravenscroft, describes this guy, and I can't think of his name now, it's been so long since I read it, but he was he met Hitler and ended up becoming part of the Nazi occult bureau. And he was a British citizen. And when he saw what was happening in Germany, he decided that he couldn't participate anymore. And he managed to get back to Britain and talk to Churchill. And it was this guy's explanation to Churchill that opened up an entirely new, I don't know if it was new, but it was certainly new to the soldiers on the ground. A new concept of what the hell they were fighting for. Because Adolf Hitler was in World War I, and he got mustard gassed. And we know from descriptions of things that have been done to super soldiers and other of the mind control things that chemicals often can cause a problem that can actually develop paranormal tendencies. So maybe that was what triggered Hitler. Who knows? Maybe it was his sole mission, probably. But what happened was that he was in the, after the war, he was very desolate. He was doing artwork and not really being very successful. Well, wasn't successful at all. But he ended up going to the Hofburg Treasure Museum, and there he saw the Spear of Destiny. And he had some kind of a vision that led him on a quest for more and more information about the spear. And because he was doing that, he ended up interfacing with people who were part of the secret societies of Germany, in particular the Thule Society, T-H-U-L-E. And those people took him under their wings and began to nurture him, because they believed that there would be a man that would come and lead the German people. Now, what the Spear of Destiny has to do with this is that in my book, I'm going to tell you that I believe there was a conspiracy based on Holy Blood, Holy Grail, between the Zealots and the Essenes that were Jewish tribes. The Essenes were mystics, the Zealots were politically active, and they contrived this crucifixion event. In fact, Jesus did die and resurrect, but in the Zealots' mind, there was going to be a pretend death. And how they were going to make this pretend death was that instead of putting vinegar on the sponge that's put up to the mouth of the crucified victim to revive them, the Essenes, who were also doctors, put a drug in there that would give the semblance of death. So Jesus was going to look like he was dead, and they would take him down, because there was a stipulation that was actually illegal by Roman law, that the Roman law said a crucified victim has to stay on the cross until they fall down because the birds have eaten them or whatever. But in Jesus' case, he was supposed to be taken down and buried before sunset. So to effectively do this within a short period of time, the soldiers were going to have to break his legs, and by having the legs broken, he wouldn't be able to push up in order to breathe, because he's hanging from his wrist, and so now his chest is constricted, and he's got to fight for every breath, so they would have to stand up in order to breathe. Well, if you don't, you can't stand up because your legs are broken, you will suffocate within a few minutes. So they put the sponge up to his mouth, and he seemingly dies, but Longinus was the Roman centurion that was responsible for overseeing the crucifixion. And he apparently, based on everything I know about him, had a kind of a mystical experience that he connected with Jesus on the cross and was totally motivated by a compassion to end the suffering. And he had in his hands the ceremonial spear of the Jewish people. And he took the spear and pierced the side of Jesus, thus killing Jesus, destroying the zealots' plan, they think. And the Essenes have got a stage upon which they have proven the resurrection. And so the spear of destiny now goes down in history as being a turning point for the entire future of mankind. And the next time it shows up, with the Merovingians in France. And it seems that Mary Magdalene, who was in fact Jesus' wife, I get a lot of flack about that, but when you look at the definition...
Oh, no, I quite agree. They had a daughter, Sarah, amongst others.
Yes. So Sarah and Mary Magdalene go back to France, or go to France, and they are with the Essene community there, and they have the Spear of Destiny, or what was by then known as the Spear of Destiny because of what had happened when it was, and it's not on a stick anymore. Well, it probably was on another stick, but basically it's a spearhead that's got the magic in it. So the offshoot, the descendants of Jesus married into the Franks, the French Gothic type of people, the Merovingi was the prince, and so they ended up marrying in and became a royal dynasty, the Merovingians. And from the Merovingians, it ended up in the hands of Charlemagne. And then it goes through all of a number of different kings throughout Europe. It ended up in different hands. But there were certain requirements. First off, you had to have a legal right to the spear before you could control its powers. The second thing was that supposedly if you dropped it, you would lose the powers. There were some other little quirky things about the spear itself. So it ends up in the Hofburg Museum, and Adolf Hitler comes under its hypnotic power. And when he becomes Chancellor of Germany, the first thing he does is attack Austria, not attack by military forces, but they attacked with everything they could to bring the Austrian people to a point where they would say, yes, we will agree to unite with Germany. And 4 days after that election, when the Austrian people agreed to unite with Germany, Adolf Hitler, in a secret mission, went to the Hofburg and picked up the Spear of Destiny. Then they took the spear and they put it in the a church in Nuremberg, where they had other regalia from the Habsburgs, the crown, a lot of other stuff. And it was there in the heart of Nazism, which was Nuremberg. And it stayed there in the church until the first RAF bombing of Nuremberg, and the roof of the church was severely damaged, and that freaked them out, so they moved the Spear of Destiny. That move coincided with the downfall of the Nazi regime. Right after that, they got creamed by the Russians, and everything went downhill from the moving of the spear. And I suspect that that was equivalent to the dropping of the spear. And
yes,
at that point in time, nobody knew where the spear was. Now, this guy that I was telling about earlier, the one that was responsible for Trevor Ravenscroft writing the book, The Spear of Destiny, it was his story. he tells Churchill about the spear and how Adolf Hitler thinks that this is the most important power point of his power base. And so Churchill says, well, I don't know if I agree with believing it or not, but if he does, I want to get it away from him. So they actually sent teams in to Germany trying to find the spear. And I've seen the actual report from the army troops that were right there in Nuremberg. And I think they were probably more like looting than on any kind of an official business. But they're walking around long, and they see a hole in the side of the street. And they investigate, and they find out that the hole is there's a tunnel. And so they open up the hole, and they go through the tunnel, and they get to the end of the tunnel, and there is a bank vault. And they go back, and at that point, the 7th Army was headquartered in Nuremberg, and they went back and reported their find. And inside that vault was supposedly the Spear of Destiny.
Dun, dun, dun. And so it was captured by the Allies.
It was captured by the Allies.
And then where did it go, and who's got it now? And how Nazi is it?
Well, there's stories that the spear that was in the Nuremberg tunnel was actually a fake one, and that the spear ended up in the German Antarctica, in their base down there, and that the Nazis still have control over the Spear of Destiny. For reasons that I can't get into, the spear was not there. The spear that's now in the Hofburg Museum is not the Spear of Destiny. The spear is not in the hands of the Nazis. I'm fairly certain that the entity that has the Spear of Destiny right now is what we call Gaia or Mother Earth.
So, it's safe for the moment, and we're safe for the moment, because obviously this is a very important artifact. If the Nazis, presumably that's what they've done, they've spread out over the world, find the artifact, because that's their key. It's the key to the big lock of locking the planet, isn't it? The whole New World Order and thing.
Exactly. But what happened was that, I believe that we are assisted by faster than light beings, archangels, gnome, Gaia herself, the consciousness of Earth. I believe that we are always assisted. And at that moment in time, when the United States took it over, officially, the powers on the other side could not allow that to happen. So it was effectively shattered. Now, it wasn't that the physical 3D version of it was shattered. They shattered the energies. And the energies were put into different objects. And so you would have to know all the objects and put them together to bring the Spear of Destiny back into something.
This sounds like who's that guy? Harrison Ford. What's it? What's that guy? It's gone completely out of my mind.
No.
Indiana Jones. That's the one. Yeah, I mean, this is the same story, isn't it?
It's very similar. I mean, any type of fiction is just a manifestation of what's really in the super consciousness. You're telling a story. It's like I wrote a book called Non-Left Crusade. It's a fictional book, but it is a fiction. I don't know.
Look, I've got to have you back. You got to come back. This has been brilliant. Thank you very much. It's been 2 hours. Thank you very much, Nancy Hopkins. Do go to cosmicreality.weebly.com. cosmicreality.weebly.com. Buy her book. Make her happy. She's amazing. Thank you very much, Nancy. God bless you.
God bless you. Thanks.